one set of questions or not?
I'm not sure.
Those are 38?
That's
right. All right, we are in Genesis 38. Let me say as I begin that I want to thank Jonathan for teaching last Wednesday while I was in Memphis. Appreciate him doing that. And we will make up chapter 37's questions in class next week when we go over chapter 39. Until that time, we're going to cover chapter 38 of Genesis and notice some things in that regard as we go through here. Chapter 37 deals with who?
Joseph.
Joseph. All right. Chapter 38 deals with who?
Joseph.
Jacob. Jacob. It's interesting because chapter 37 introduces Joseph, and it seems like it would be an opportune time, the way Moses typically writes, to continue with Joseph and continue on that path up until the point where, he concludes with Joseph and moves on to another figure, as he typically does. He typically goes through and splits it up by character and not necessarily by section in a different way. But what he's going to do is he's going to start Joseph, swing back to Jacob, then go back to Joseph, but it's not in chronological order. If you were to assume that these events happened around the same time as Joseph being sold into slavery, you're probably wrong. Now, some of them may have occurred close to that time, at least the beginning. But by the time you get to the end of chapter 38, you've gotten almost, most likely, almost to the point where they are going to be entering Egypt soon. So chapter 38 is one of those chapters that gets tossed in because of the principles in it and the emphasis of it, and it's not in chronological order. When you step into chapter 39... from the end of chapter 38 to the beginning of chapter 39, you've gone backwards at least 20 years from the events that take place. But you've got at least 20 years in chapter 38. So you're just going back to where chapter 37 left off. It's a little confusing when you think about it from the chronological perspective, but hopefully we can shine some more light on why. Verse 1, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. About what time? All right. They sold Joseph into slavery, and based on the statement that Moses makes, Judah doesn't hang around very long after that.
So why are you saying there's 20 years difference between chapter 37 and chapter 38?
Because between verses 11 and 12 of chapter 38, you've got about 20 years that transpire. So the end of chapter 38 is 20 years later on, but the beginning is right there. And so when you get to chapter 39, you're putting it back in reverse and going to the end of chapter 37. So that's how this transpires chronologically.
So the time of Genesis 37, 36 to 39, 1 is the same.
Mm-hmm.
You just, because of this count, we
can hear you're fast forwarding real quick.
Mm-hmm. You've got this section that's in here that's the beginning of it's basically in chronological order, but by the time you get to the end, you've got to go backwards to catch back up with Joseph. But my personal belief as to the reason why it's inserted here, because this account could be given and do no harm to the account itself. It could be given right before his brothers come to Egypt to buy food that first time, because it would fit perfectly in the chronology of that period, in the sense that by the time you get to the end of chapter 38, you could walk right into, there's a famine in the land, and now they're coming to Egypt to buy grain. That would work great. But I think it's here for a reason. I think, not to say that the Holy Spirit would just randomly put it somewhere, but I think it's there for a specific reason, and here's why. What is it that Judah does in chapter 38? Say what?
He raped his sister.
No. You're thinking about something entirely different. Who was Tamar to Judah? You're thinking of the other Tamar. Yes. All right. You're thinking of the Tamar in 1 Samuel, who is the daughter of David, who's raped by her brother.
And
her
half-brother.
Yes.
Yes.
So, Tamar is Judah's daughter-in-law, the wife, as we're going to see in the text, the wife of his oldest son, and he will unknowingly commit fornication with her and produce seed.
But she'll have evidence that indicts him in action.
Right. Now, here's the reason why I think this passage, or this section, this account, is here. What transpires in chapter 39?
Just the Potiphar's
wife. Exactly. Chapter 38, you've got Judah, the one not sold into slavery, the one with all the benefits of still being among his own people and his own family, who chooses to leave, chooses to associate with the Canaanites, who leaves home and his morals get messed up. And he commits fornication. You have Joseph, who gets sold into slavery, who gets taken to Egypt, who has no connection at all anymore with his family, and stands fast in God, and refuses to do exactly what his brother is going to do. And you see even the connections of the idea that Joseph could have said, well, nobody will find out, which is exactly what Judah said. Judah had the mentality, nobody's going to find out. And yet, they did. No, it was Reuben who said, do not slay. Right. I don't believe any of them are specifically named as having said, kill him.
Yes. Verse 24, Judah said, bring your boys and let them be burnt. Okay.
Oh, are you talking about Tamar, or are you talking about Joseph?
When they sold Joseph.
Right. I don't think Judah, verse 26, said, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him. So it was his idea to sell Joseph. He said, it doesn't do us any good if we kill him. Let's just sell him. No body to be found. Is the idea. Alright, so this is the reason why I think this account is inserted here. It's a contrast between the life of Joseph and the life of Judah, and simultaneously it's going to be a very clear explanation as to why God brings the family of Israel down into Egypt to become a nation. Instead of allowing them to become a nation in Palestine, instead of allowing them to remain in Canaan and become a nation, he takes them down into Egypt. He creates a nation of them there, but there's something unique about their situation in Egypt. In Canaan, they're amongst the people. How many times have they had problems already since Jacob returned? How many times have they had problems with the people in the land? Okay? When you come over to their time in Egypt, you don't have that. And here's the reason. They were put in Goshen, and you may remember, Joseph told his brothers, when you come before Pharaoh and he asks you what you do, what did Joseph tell them to answer? You remember? He said, tell them you're shepherds. Why? Because shepherds were an abomination to Egyptians. The Egyptians refused to be shepherds. They hired out their shepherding of their flocks because it was an abomination in their eyes. Well, if you've got a whole people that's nothing but shepherds, and they're all an abomination to you, what do? You stick them in a land and you leave them alone. Which is exactly what the Egyptians did. They put them in Goshen, which was the best of the land of Egypt, and they left them alone. Which allowed Israel to go from being a family to a nation without all the struggles they had morally in Canaan. All of the difficulties that they had and all of the temptations that they had because they were intermingled with the people, once they got into Egypt, they weren't intermingled anymore. Because the Egyptians didn't want anything to do with them. Because they were shepherds. Right. You have some of that, but in even in Exodus, you see there's a division. But there's the land that the Israelites are in, and there's the land that the Egyptians are in. Okay? So, you're going to see a separation here, and it leads up to, or this passage leads up to, God saying the idea that even Joseph will mention that God sent me to Egypt to save you. It was God's plan all along for Joseph to go to Egypt and prepare a place for them. All right, so you're going to see all of that tie together as we go along. Now, Adullam, where Hira the Adullamite is from. Based on the information that I have, it is in Palestine, a short distance from Gath, on the border of what would be the kingdom of Israel. So, if you remember where Isaac was and Jacob was up until the point where Isaac died, they're down in this region, down here, when Isaac dies, down in this area. And so Jacob is going to come up out of that region and go to the area of Gath. And I intended to find it exactly on the map, and I forgot to do so. Hold on just a sec. Somebody look and see if you have Gath or Adullam on your map. I'm sure it's on my other map, but not on this one.
Gath is in the land of the Philistines.
Okay.
By Ashdod.
Alright. So, Gath would have been about here in this region.
It has it over towards the border of Judah.
Okay, so about here?
Yes.
Alright, so Gath would have been about here. They were down here. He comes north into this region to Adullam. And the New King James says, and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. So he's come out of the land. He's gone to this specific individual, and that's going to be a problem. We're going to see that as we go along. Verse 2, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he married her and went in to her. Now the indication is that Shua is the name of the Canaanite, not the daughter. So, a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. So, the daughter's name, Judah's wife's name, is never actually given. The first time I read through that, I read it the opposite. I read Shua as being his wife's name. But the text seems to indicate that's her father's name. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. He was at Kizib when she bore him. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So, Judah's relationship, this is question number one, Judah's relationship with what Adullamite led to the events recorded in this chapter? Hira. Alright, that's the name of the Adullamite. Name Judah's three sons born by the daughter of Shua the Canaanite. Alright, Onan, Shelah. Those are his original three sons. Verse 6, then Judah took a wife from his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. So, son number one gets a wife, but then God kills him because of his wickedness. Okay? Now, it's interesting. All of this transpires. Judah still hasn't returned. He went up to this Adullamite, but he hasn't gone back. So all of this transpires while Judah is not in the same region with his family. He's out away from the remainder of his family. So, dies. Verse 8, Judah said to Onan, his secondborn, go in to your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and it came to pass when he went in to his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give her an heir, or give an heir to his brother. So, he is told by his father, Tamar's now yours. And you raise up an heir to her. Why would he do that? Why raise up an heir to his older brother? All right. The connection of the firstborn. The inheritance. The inheritance belonged to the family of the firstborn male child. But if he's married and does not bear seed before he dies, then the only way for the inheritance to continue through his family is for a child to be born to him. Well, what happens in the Old Testament, in this, back in the patriarchal age as well as in the Mosaical age, is that it was established that if the firstborn dies, the second male child would then take his wife and raise up children to the firstborn. So the child didn't belong to Onan, it belonged to Ur. Now, why would Onan not want to give a child to the lineage of Ur? As soon as there's a child for Ur, he doesn't get the inheritance. He doesn't get the birthright. If there's no child, then it automatically has to go to the next closest kin in line for the inheritance. It's all about him. And notice, when you go over to the book of Ruth, and you see Boaz address the nearest kinsman, he tells him that there's a land to redeem. He tells him about this possession, this inheritance to be redeemed. And the guy's all for it. Until there's a wife that comes with it. And children that are going to get that inheritance, and his family isn't. As soon as that comes into the picture, the guy has no interest. He doesn't want it. He backs out of the deal. He says, no, you go ahead. Okay? So, that's the situation similar here. Onan doesn't want to bear seed to Ur because then Onan doesn't get the inheritance. Now, when it says in the King James and New King James, when he went in to Tamar, the idea here in the Hebrew is that this was not a one-time occurrence, this was every time. This is a continual action. Every time he went into Tamar. So he was willing to take her as a wife and use her sexually, but not actually bring forth seed for his brother. And so God is going to, verse 10, the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he, the Lord, killed him, Onan, also. So, Judas had two children from a wife who was a Canaanite, out from his own kindred among the Canaanites, and both of them been killed by God because of their wickedness. It should be an indication about the morality of the people he was around, because even his children were being killed by God. All right?
Well, but it doesn't show much to his parenting either that his children are wicked enough that the Lord would kill them.
Absolutely. So, and you're going to see that even more so later on. Verse 11, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So the attitude of Judah is, there's some connection here. Everybody that marries Tamar ends up dead. And I don't want my third and only remaining son dead like the other two. So he says he's not of marrying age yet. Go back to your father's house, and when he is, he'll be given to you. He will take you as a wife. Now, like I said, between verse 11 and verse 12, you have a period of time that passes. We don't know exactly how much, but here's what we do know. Verse 1, Judah didn't have a wife and didn't have any children. By the time you come to verse 11, he's had two grown children, a third who is not yet of marrying age, at least that's his excuse, and by the time you come to verse 12, his wife dies. So you do have a significant amount of time that transpires between verse 1 and verse 12. Enough for children to be born and be of marrying age, and a second child to be born and be of marrying age, and a third child to be born and not be of marrying age. So, you've got some time that transpires by the time you get to verse 12. Now, in the process of time, and Moses indicates time passes. Now, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. Every time you read that man's name, there's trouble. It's a good indication. God's leaving a point to be learned. And it was told Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given him as a wife. So she recognizes what Judah promised he had not kept, and so she intentionally changes her appearance. She before was dressed like a widow, someone who was respectable, someone who had had a husband. But also there's a sense in which she would have been dressed to show also the fact that she had a husband but had no children. It would have been an indication of her status in among her people. She changes that attire, and she covers herself with a veil, wraps herself, and sits in an open place. And the indication seems to be that this was a clear, distinct image of how a prostitute would have looked in that time, in that civilization, in that location. She would have been dressed in such a way that this would have indicated what her occupation was. So, she goes, and verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Now, Edwin Jones makes this statement concerning this passage. He said, Tamar's plot draws attention to the practice of cult prostitution that was a strong feature of Canaanite religion. Fornication with a special class of prostitute, which she's going to be stated as a cult prostitute later on in the passage. Fornication with a special class of prostitute was designed, notice, to increase fertility in both the fields and the flocks. At the time of sheep shearing, Judah would have been especially concerned about the future of his flocks and perhaps especially vulnerable to Tamar. So she not only dresses like a prostitute, but she dresses like a specific kind of prostitute. One that would have been involved in Canaanite worship to the glorying of the gods that would have resulted in increased plenty in the fields and the flocks. What does that indicate to you about Judah's religion? Not worshiping God, because he knew who she was. He recognized who she was and the purpose. So it wasn't just the aspect of the sexual nature, but very closely tied to the Canaanite religious mentality. So he was down with his family. Joseph gets sold into slavery. He becomes a companion of Hira the Adullamite. And by the time you get to verse 12, Judah's religious practices have changed. Now, this passage should also be a warning for us that those whose spouses have died are especially and recognizably susceptible to temptation that they most likely wouldn't have been susceptible to before. Because their marriage partner, their sexual partner, is dead, is gone. Therefore, they've had a relationship and they had the ability to enjoy the marriage relationship prior to this that now they don't have anymore. And so when you take someone and you put them in that situation, they become more susceptible to temptation because what they had, they no longer have. So it's something that, you know, that was a point that was made by a number of different commentators on the passage, and it's a good point to remember that when someone goes through that, we need to be conscious of making sure that we encourage them, we help them remain strong, faithful, spiritually, physically, deal with the grief, deal with the loss, but also deal with the other issues as well. So, verse 16, then he turned to her, by the way, and said, please let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law, for she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? So, notice one statement here. The statement, for he did not know. The clear implication is, if he had known, he wouldn't have done it. But there's an underlying factor beyond inside of this.
Then he would have done it even if he knew it wasn't her, he still would have probably done it.
Well, it's the fact that he did do it, believing, you know, it wasn't anybody new. But there's the aspect of anonymity. This is one of the biggest problems that exists with pornography and the internet. Mm-hmm. people believe nobody's going to find out. But even just beyond that, fornication and prostitution, the idea is there's anonymity in it. Nobody's going to find out because I don't know this person. You know, if it's somebody that you know, then they may know your family and they may know your friends. But if it's somebody you don't know, then they don't know you and they can't tell anybody. But it's the exact opposite. Especially, and this was a point that was made by a preacher I was talking to concerning the idea of pornography on the internet, that so many people, it's the exact opposite of what you believe. The idea is nobody will ever find out because it's in private, you know, nobody will ever know. All you have to do is delete the history. It's the exact opposite. Because of the way the internet works, not only is it always buried inside your computer, but your ISP, your internet service provider, it's always in their history. Every website you ever visit is logged on their servers. Every search engine that you use as a node to get to a website, it's logged in their servers. It never goes away. The exact opposite is true from anonymity. As a matter of fact, it is to the point now where it lives forever in the internet. The internet never forgets what transpires on the internet because of the way it's built. Redundancy and the archive of every piece of data. It's always there. So, but with the statement here concerning Judah, he believed that it was anonymous. He believed that he would get away with it because he wasn't in his home country. He wasn't with his family. Now, connect that to Joseph. He wasn't with his family. He wasn't in his home country. Who would have found out? But what was Joseph's response? How can I commit this sin against my God? Did you have a comment or a question?
But, regarding Judah and his actions, so it would be the case that we could, it would be okay to assume though, that he has done this before.
No.
I think there's a reason.
His wife has died. And I think there's a connection there. I don't think it's by accident that Moses points that out. That there's something that transpires here. Go ahead.
But why else would Tamar then choose to do it this way? I mean, she had to have some thought that he would stop along the way. So don't you think there may have been a...
Certainly, you could argue...
He would just stop.
You could certainly argue that it seems as though Tamar suspects... Here's a clear, obvious way to get at Judah. And that she knows he'll be susceptible to this. So, in that sense, yes, that could be an indication that she knows this is a character trait, this is a problem, and a normal occurrence with Judah. We don't know. But, she has it all planned out. So he said, "What shall I give to you?" So she said, "Your signet and cord, and your staff that is in your hand." Now, the term signet here, according to Evan Jones, the signet mentioned would have been a cylinder worn around the neck on a cord. So, the cylinder, but it was an identifying mark, by all indications. It's similar to the way years later they would use a ring as a signet to identify themselves, say this is from this individual, this family. Same thing, but it was worn around the neck. Your signet, your cord, your staff that is in your hand. Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her womanhood or widowhood. Then, and Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" And they said, "There is no harlot in this place." So he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." Also, the men of the place said that there was no harlot in this place. So she had it all planned out. She knew exactly what she needed. and knew exactly what she was going to get and the results that that would bring about and how to protect herself from any retribution by Judah, because she would have full proof that he was the one who did it. But in view of that, notice again the connection to Hira. Hira's with him as he's traveling. Hira's the one that gets sent back to pay the price of the prostitute. Somehow reminding me of 1 Corinthians 15:33. Evil companions corrupt good morals. It seems very clear from the passage that Hira has had an influence on the life of Judah and on his actions. And that Hira has no problem with it at all. So, Judah said, verse 23, let her take them for herself, that is, the prostitute that he believed to be a prostitute, take that which he had given her, lest we be ashamed. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. So, his mindset, Judah's mindset is, we'll only be found out if she says something, but as long as she's got what she wants, as long as she's satisfied with what she has, then that's fine. But if we keep searching for her, somebody's going to find out. Somebody's going to be made aware. It's going to be realized. And then we're going to suffer the shame of what has occurred. Came to pass. How much time do I have left? A minute? All right. Came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. Couple of points concerning this. Tamar would still have been considered engaged to Judah's son, Shelah. So it's not just the idea that she was a woman who has committed adultery or committed fornication, but she is one who was engaged. She was promised, even though Judah hadn't given Shelah to her, she was promised, and when you go back into the Old Testament attitudes towards that engagement period, the engagement period was as strict as the marriage covenant was, or almost to that point.
But isn't that why she did it?
Oh, absolutely.
Because from what Eddie was saying, it sounded like she knew he had maybe done all this before, but she didn't know that he was going to from the verses in 13 and 14, it says 13, she was told about it. In 14, she realized his son was grown, and she was promised that and never received it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are the reasons why she probably went after it, not that he had done this before.
Right. Well, no, I think her point is she immediately knew what she could do to get him to do this, and therefore it was a recognition of his character, Judah's character.
But from what it's saying, though, it's
right.
Not saying he had probably done this.
Right. Eddie?
I just say, I don't know that she would have come up with it immediately, but there had to have been, I guess in my mind, there must have been some indication that this is how I could get him in a trap, in a something for what he's done to me. Otherwise, I think she wouldn't have gone so far out of her way to do that, because it indicates that she had traveled to do this. So that was my point. I just find it interesting that there must have been something in his character that led her to believe this will work, or she would have tried something else, so she thought it would work.
It seems very clear that she knew Judah's weaknesses in this regard, and therefore she used this method to achieve her goal as a result of Judah not giving the youngest son to be her husband. All right? You are dismissed, and we'll pick up there next week.